From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Super excited about today's show. We have Matt Nato on the show, and we're going to be talking about winning. We're going to be talking about what happens as you win, after you win, winning mindset, because there's a lot of strategy and tactics that go into this. And just a little bit of a disclaimer, and Matt can help me disclaim, but we're going to be talking a little bit about tax, and we're not coming across and professing ourselves as tax professionals. Matt's a wealth manager, but he understands strategy associated with winning. And so I would say don't take this as investment advice either, but we might be talking about that stuff. So just think of us as two buddies talking about things that we all really, really care about. So with that said, Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
You betcha. Maybe we can start off with just a little bit of your background. And, you know, you're from Massachusetts, which I need to give you, I don't want to say give you a hard time about, because I love Massachusetts. I love going to Boston. My wife's, I think, on her way there this weekend, especially in the fall. It's great.
I'm going there,
but
too.
But you're a Patriot.
I'm actually going there, too, this weekend.
This weekend?
Yeah.
Are you flying out Saturday?
I'm flying out tonight, red eye.
Tonight. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So she's flying out Saturday. So that's interesting. Okay. So you're a Patriots fan, and this year is not. I'm a Niners fan. You saw the coasters on the table, and so that maybe that's how we can break the ice a little bit. Is with the Patriots have found a way to win. They've had a winning mindset over the last several years. The Niners have done pretty well over the years. This year, the Patriots don't look like they're going to be as strong as the Niners. Thoughts? That's all of a sudden became a sports show.
Not only am I not an expert in taxes, but I'm also not an expert in the sports scene. All I'll say is it's been a wonderful run here. You know, growing up in Massachusetts, and especially being an 80s kid, you know, I was an 80s kid. There was no success in baseball. There was no success in football. We had the Celtics, which we can always fall back on, but they're kind of lower in my sports hierarchy. And so it was tough in the 80s, in the 90s. It really was. And so people always want to bust my chops about all the success we've had with both of those organizations over the past 20 years, but it's been rough sledding heading up to that. And like I alluded to earlier, you know, the sports, it's cyclical.
Yeah,
you know?
it's interesting. It's like the economy, right?
Yeah.
It's cyclical.
Yep.
Scott and I are my teammate over there. We're always talking Niners because we're big time Niners fans. And all of a sudden, they look like they could be, not all of a sudden, they look like they could be a pretty good team this year. So I've diverted from the subject at hand, kind of tied it together with winning. But you work with people who have won in life or are winning in life. They figured out a way to have success in business typically. And maybe talk to us a little bit about what it's like to work with those people, because as a wealth manager or somebody that, you know, is doing what you do, you end up getting to know these people really, really well.
Intimately, for
and
sure.
And yep. You probably see some, and you're highly successful, some common trends in the most successful. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, for me, it's fun because they're either winning from a business perspective or they're winning on the real estate side as well, right? So it's either one of those two facets. And for me, there's always a moment of learning each and every time I have an opportunity to peel back the onion with a client and or a prospect, right? Because we go really deep. And in some cases, it's almost so intimate where we're, you know, I feel like there's a patient lying down on the couch in front of me and they're professing.
Sometimes there's dirty laundry, I have to imagine. You're like,
laundry.
Hey, the kids, they're a little, here's what one kid is doing right now.
There's some dirty laundry for, there's no doubt about that. But for me, I love... Like, I think that's one of the traits that I have that's made me so successful is I'm so interested in other people and I'm so interested in learning about their stories and I'm so interested in terms of how they built themselves to where they are today, right? Mm-hmm. Where were you 20, 25, 30 years ago? Here you are now. What did you do to become so successful? And what are those common denominators and or traits? So it's really cool to learn about their successes. And I would say in terms of a common thread to answer your initial question, It's perseverance.
Mm.
Perseverance. I mean, that's, you know, that's no secret here, but, it's just grinding.
Do you feel like people, let's maybe break it up into people that are successful in real estate and people that are successful in building their own business. You know, a lot of times every business starts off as a small business and, you know, with big dreams typically, but then it ends up becoming way harder, right? Than you expect. And so you need that perseverance. You need to figure it out, grind it out, those kind of things. And because as an entrepreneur, we get so caught up in our business that sometimes we're almost surprised when it becomes successful, and we're so in the business that stepping back and going, okay, let's be ready when the time is right to potentially have an exit or, you know, grab some liquidity out of our business. And how do you do that? So you find that people are surprised by that sometimes?
Absolutely. And I think there's a difference between working in your business versus working on your business. I'm sure you probably have heard that before, but I think there's a big distinction there. When I say working in our business, it's in the trenches, day to day, hand to hand combat. And all of a sudden you look up 15, 20 years later and you're like, holy cow, I actually accomplished something pretty cool. Right. And that's the case for myself too, which is kind of interesting. But I think when people finally look up, take a breather and realize what they accomplished, then there's an opportunity to work on their business and what those next steps are, whether it's, you know, a liquidity stage, or how do we unwind their portfolio of real estate in a very tax efficient manner, things of that nature. So yeah, I think there's a true difference of working in versus on your business.
And there are people that are not successful too. So maybe run the contrast on that, because we all see people that maybe start these businesses and maybe don't do as well, or maybe they're just not quite as successful. Any trends there where you see people maybe with less success? And maybe
I think number one is not an unwavering belief in themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. Number one. And you know, that creates doubt, and it's just a negative feedback loop. I've seen that with some friends over the years. I've seen that with colleagues. I've seen that with some of my clients, in fact, very early on. And so I think you do have to have this unwavering belief in yourself that you can do whatever it is that you want to do. And again, I know that sounds kind of corny, so to speak, but I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, one of the things I've seen is people that end up, we all have doubts, right? We all have these uncertainties when we're looking to achieve something that's maybe uncommon. And one of the things that I've seen in highly successful people is they find a way to put the right people in their life to help eliminate some of those doubts and fears, and choosing the right teammates. And in cases like what we're talking about with you, choosing the right wealth manager or financial advisor. Those things they sort of demystify it. And so you're not as worried about it.
Yeah. Surrounding yourself with the right people, right? Building up your team, whether it's having, you know, your CPA, your estate planning attorney, your real estate guy, your wealth manager, surrounding yourself with successful people, like-minded in a way, but also will challenge you in a sense as well. So I think that's important. And then also going back to your initial question about a moment ago about, you know, why aren't people successful? I also think that people get distracted. And so I think being able to specialize and really focus on one thing that you're really good at is very paramount in anyone's success. And so the people that, again, I've seen flounder around, they're not specializing in any one thing and they're not truly focused on what that passion is. They get distracted.
Yeah.
So I think those really ultra high net worth individuals that experience a lot of success, they also have that ability to be super focused and be super specialized and really good at what they do.
Yeah. We all hear that term, chasing shiny objects. And I think we're entrepreneurs. And you're an entrepreneur, I'm an entrepreneur, and there's a draw to, lull is not the right term. There's sort of a lure, you know, we're lured toward cool, you know, we've created a little bit of freedom for ourselves at some level sometimes. And we're lured into this idea of we can do this, we can do that, we can do all these things great. But invariably, it's hard to be great at that many things.
It truly is. Yeah. There's no doubt about it.
So thinking about that. Okay. Now, one more thing I wanted to kind of think about in terms of, you have successful people and then you have these successful families. You work with family businesses, I assume, at times. And then in the family, there's these, you know, it's multi-generational. So especially when it's a first generation success story, and then their children are, you know, when you're planning things out, you're thinking about what about the kids? And the kids sometimes aren't as well prepared because they weren't the ones that earned it, but yet they may be the ones that inherit it. Any thoughts on preparing people to come into money when they're not the ones that actually did the perseverance part?
I'm going to say that that's really the responsibility of the parents more than anything else. You know, that's foundational. I think that should be taught very early on. So I guess that's what I would say to some of the business owners that are out there that have young children, is get them involved early and get them involved often in your business. And, you know, not only the day to day, the successes, but also the failures, too. I think it's very important for kids to see us fail. I really, really do. And I say that because I actually had a friend recently that experienced a failure, and he was ashamed to kind of bring it to his kids because he was afraid of how they would react or perceive him. And I think it's really, really important for your kids to not only see your successes, but more importantly, see you fail and how you respond to that failure.
That's interesting, because one of my favorite quotes is on the wall over there from Ronald Reagan. All great change in America begins at the dinner table, which really, in today's society, dinner table may be taking your kid to karate or, you know, something like that, because there's not as much time where you're sitting down having dinner. But I take that comment in today's society as we have to talk to our children. But I really hadn't thought about describing your failures, being that vulnerable, because you know, they have us typically, especially, I know your kids are like 8, 7, and 11. Mine are now adults. They know how messed up I am at times. My kids get it because they're old and they've seen it. But I was also, I think they also saw the truth, right? They get it. My wife and I didn't really hide, the challenges associated with, you know, growing businesses or anything else. It was like we were a team as a family. And I feel like that was helpful a little bit.
Oh, 100%. It had to be, right? Yeah. They're part of the fabric of the business very early on, and they were emotionally involved just as you and your wife were. Yeah. So I just think that's huge. And so, you know, we know that we learn more by failing than we do sometimes in our successes. And so, oftentimes I'll come home and, you know, we're talking to the kids around the dinner table, and I will highlight a challenge. I will highlight something that I truly failed at. But to your point, it takes a lot of vulnerability, right? Because my 7 and 11 year olds, they still love me.
Dad's the best. He's the strongest man in the world.
Dad's the best, right? You know? And so there's a part of me that doesn't want to make myself vulnerable, and I don't want to bring myself down, to that level, but I think you have to.
Yeah.
I think you have to prepare them for the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to imagine that teaches them some amount of humility that can probably help them today, right? On the playground, but in karate, in whatever it is. It's like, look, we're gonna go through times when it doesn't go as well as we think, and we have to deal with it. Yep. Yeah. Okay, so I want to dive into the maybe some of the more technical things around when you start having that success. So we talked about, as I mentioned at the beginning, really you have people that win in business, and then some of those same people win in real estate, but other people end up winning in real estate that maybe don't build highly successful companies. So there's we're going to talk about a few things that our normal accountants don't really talk to us about, right? So I've got accountants, I've got a bunch of businesses, but my accountants, they're typically not as strategic, especially or technical when it comes to some of these really unique tax strategies associated with winning. And so we're going to talk about the DST. There's the Delaware Statutory Trust, is common in real estate. We're going to talk about deferred sales trust and also opportunity zones, which are typically done in real estate too. So maybe we'll even reverse that. Yep. Talk about qualified opportunity zones first, and then bring in the deferred sales trust, which is less common, but I think it's still important. So maybe if you can, maybe we'll start with the Delaware Statutory Trust, which is pretty common. It's in part of the 1031 exchange.
It is, yeah. It wasn't as common, say, 2 or 3 years ago, okay. but I think because there's been this mass exodus for people to start unwinding their real estate portfolios over the past couple of years, right? I mean, there was a time where a lot of my clients were coming to me for these types of solutions, and you know, the buildings were selling like that. Of course, this was in 2020, 2021, before the precipitous rise in interest rates, and now things are kind of at a standstill from a real estate standpoint. But at the end of the day, when it comes to the Delaware Statutory Trust, even though it's more common now, I'll talk to commercial real estate guys. I'll talk to developers. I will talk to mortgage people, mortgage folks, and they don't know, CPAs, and they don't know about this strategy. And what's interesting is if you've been in this business for 20, 25, 30 years, or you've been an accountant for 30 years and you don't hear of a concept, you automatically think that it's not good, right? Oh, if I didn't hear about it, it can't be good. It can't be legit. Right. And so I've faced some adversity as it relates to that earlier on, as it relates to the Delaware Statutory Trust, because it was somewhat of a newer concept to them, even though it's been around for 15, 20 years. And that came out, that was born. The Delaware Statutory Trust was born from the TIC industry, the TICs, the tenants in common, which was an absolute disaster, right? If you think about it. And so the Delaware Statutory Trust is the ultimate solution for somebody that wants to really unwind part of their real estate portfolio. They're done with the tenants, the termites, and the toilets, right? They're done with the three T's, and it's time for them to sit back a little bit, still collect that passive income. And the beauty of the Delaware Statutory Trust is we get to defer all of the taxes associated with the sale and the depreciation recapture. And we're still doing it utilizing the 1031 exchange, but we don't necessarily have to go into a physical piece of real estate where you're now having to deal with the three T's again.
Okay, so it's not, okay, so let's break this down. Let's slow it down for C student and me. I actually own this building. So I have equity in it. So let's say I decided at some point I'm going to want to sell this building and, you know, I'm tired of it. Walk me through things I might want to think about and how this might, you know, how I might go about that.
Number one, are your kids prepared, right, to inherit this building? That's number one.
Okay.
Right. Because, and going back to our original conversation as it relates to succession planning and thinking about if your kids are ready or even if they care to own your parcel of real estate. I have some clients that have children that have grown up in the real estate business. And when mom and dad pass away, they're going to inherit this real estate and they're going to manage it and they're going to love doing it. Conversely, I have clients who have, you know, $50 million portfolio of real estate and their kids are successful, but they have no business or they have no interest in terms of taking over that real estate or taking the reins, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is an ideal solution for that particular person that, again, doesn't necessarily have a proper succession plan, not a proper succession plan, but their kids are not interested in taking over the business or taking over the real estate.
Okay. So I'm going to dive back into this, but just a little plug for my daughter. She's a tremendous realtor and does property management. She actually manages this building and others, a bunch of Airbnb type stuff for us too. So that wouldn't be the case for us, but let's assume that it is. Yeah. Shout out for anybody that's listening that just know what my daughter does, but okay, let's assume she doesn't. You know, my kids are more like they're off chasing their dreams in some other fashion.
Let's say you buy this building for $2 million and then you're looking for an exit in 15 years and it's $15 million,
okay.
Right? You're staring down the barrel of $13 million of capital gain exposure, mm-hmm. right? And I can't do the math for everybody, but everyone knows that it's going to be a lot of money in the event that you decide to sell and take constructive receipt of those funds. So what we do instead of, you know, taking a 30, 35, 40% hit in capital gains, what we do is we defer all of the gains, we defer all of the depreciation recapture in this Delaware statutory trust. The reason why it qualifies as a 1031 exchange in the eyes of the IRS is simply because it has real estate or physical real estate inside of the trust.
Okay.
All right. And that's another unique feature too, is let's face it. I mean, commercial real estate will behave. Commercial real estate is starting to decouple, right? You're seeing office really starting to struggle. Conversely, mm-hmm. you've seen self-storage do really well, right? And so maybe you own an office building that you think as though is going to, you know, decline in value in the next couple of years and you want to exit out of that now. Well, we can do a 1031 exchange into a Delaware statutory trust that might have an assisted living facility inside of it. It might have an Amazon warehouse or distribution center inside of it.
Okay, so you can go from office to industrial.
Correct.
And it's all part of this thing.
Yeah. Still like in the eyes of the
Interesting.
IRS.
And does this transaction, similar to a 1031 exchange, does it happen while you're in escrow? When does it happen?
So great question, because this is where mistakes can be costly and can happen, is that you have to talk and set up an account with a qualified intermediary first, a QI.
Okay. So you typically would do that before you even put it on the market.
You would do that. Well, not necessarily before you put it on the market, but around that time.
Okay.
You know, and it's my job too, as the advisor and the wealth manager, is to shepherd that, is to make sure that if in fact we're going to do an exchange, whether it's into a physical building or a Delaware statutory trust, that we're making all the right steps to make sure that it's going to happen. And that's the first step, is contacting a qualified intermediary. Because what's going to happen is you'll sell the commercial building or the rental property. Proceeds will go into escrow, and then from escrow, it's going to go to the qualified intermediary, and it's going to stay there until we're ready to do the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the order of operations. But what's happened in the past is someone would want to do an exchange in some capacity. They'll sell the rental property and they'll call me up and be like, "All right, Matt, we're ready to sell, or we've already sold. We're ready to do it." Mm-hmm. I'm like, "All right, well, where are the funds?" "Well, they're in my bank account."
Oh,
It's too late. It's over.
Yeah. But you can do it beforehand, or you can do it as part of the transaction. They get the offer. We've got an accepted offer, mm-hmm. and your realtor knows that you want to take advantage of this opportunity, and then you roll it into something different at that time during that process, after you've actually got your LOI or your accepted offer?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily, because remember, with a 1031 exchange, we have 45 days to mm-hmm. identify a property that we like and we're going to close on within 180 days. So those are the two hard and fast rules that the IRS has put into place. So again, it's my job to kind of help you or shepherd you through that decision-making process, where if you do want a DST, Delaware Statutory Trust, we have to make sure that we identify that within 45 days.
And so when you do that, actually, I did some of this, and splitting my, basically the boot, right? Your extra, your remainder, rolled some into some other properties. And then there was extra. So I rolled some into an Amazon building and others into multifamily stuff that I thought was mm-hmm. stronger than the building I had sold. But they were kind of like, it felt like you were going almost like into a fund, because it was became more of a passive type investment, as you mentioned earlier. Is that?
It is. It's a pooled investment at the end of the day. And people often confuse the Delaware Statutory Trust for a REIT. Or mm-hmm. a real estate investment trust, right? So you can't do a 1031 exchange into a real estate investment trust, only a Delaware statutory trust. But you are going to be in there. Like, for example, I did a deal with a client. It was I think it was about $5 million of proceeds went into an Amazon distribution center. And that Amazon distribution center was a $240 million raise. Mm-hmm. There's actually two distribution centers in this DST. And so they had their pro rata share, or appropriate percentage, mm-hmm. ownership percentage of that distribution center. And, you know, there's probably another 325, 400 investors that are in that, right, along with you. It's up for the sponsor is going to decide when to dispose of that underlying asset or that underlying property.
And who is the sponsor? Who's the sponsor?
The sponsor, I mean, there's many that are out there right now, and this is where I come in too and add value, because there's many sponsors that have come out of the woodwork because there's a lot of money to be made in the DST space right now. I would argue that half of the sponsors that have come out of the woodwork over the past couple of years will not be here in the next two or three. So it's extremely important for us to actually do a fair amount of due diligence and figure out who the right sponsor was going to be. And there's about three or four that I use.
Okay, then you can kind of help roll them into some of those trusted sponsors, and then they'll have a choice within those within their portfolio of, hey, you want Amazon, you want multifamily,
exactly,
you want some other industrial, you want... Can you do oil and gas building?
You can do oil and gas, and that's where we start to get really creative. But yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is based on your risk tolerance, your goals and objectives, we will then back into the appropriate DST with the underlying asset that's just for you.
Okay.
You know, and I will say too, I mean, this sounds like a great deal, especially for everyone that's out there in the audience that wants to sell and doesn't want to roll the proceeds into another building and be a landlord again. There are risks. There are quite a few risks that are associated with these deals, just like any real estate deal, right? You're not immune from the market going down. You're not immune from your tenant not paying rent within the DST, right? And so we got to be cognizant of that. And the biggest risk, I would say also, and I always talk about I always lead when I'm talking about a solution with a client, I always lead with what some of the bigger risks are. It's illiquidity. At the end of the day, right, if you decide, you know, you sell this building, going back to your example of $15 million, you put that $15 million into a DST.
I wish it was worth $15 million. But anyway, go ahead.
Maybe in 15 years it is.
Yeah, it could be. Never know.
You call me up and say, hey, Matt, of that fifth, call me up like 2 years later. Hey, I need $3 million of that 15. There's nothing that we can do. Mm-hmm. We cannot tap into that. There's no way. And so
you have to wait for the who decides when they're going to sell that building?
The sponsor.
Okay. So the sponsor runs it for 3, 5, 7, 10 years, whatever that time horizon, whatever the market says. And then at that time, the Amazon building sells, right? Your investment, your percentage of the investment sells. And then you can re-roll that into another one and basically continue to defer.
So that's the beauty of this whole situation, and I want to unpack that a little bit more in a second. But the crown jewel of this transaction, in my opinion, is the fact that you still get that step up in basis on this transaction. And what I mean by that is, again, going back to you bought this place for $3 million. Again, just making those numbers up. We sell it for $15 million, right? Your basis is $3 million. So when you pass away, whenever that may be, you probably live to 120 based on your energy levels and looking at great shape you're in. Once you pass away, that Delaware statutory trust gets a step up in basis. So your basis goes from $3 million to the value at the time at $15 million, and then your heirs get to liquidate that trust without necessarily paying any taxes.
Oh, interesting.
So that's the only way, and that's important, I think, for the audience to understand as well. When it comes to this transaction, the taxes and the depreciation recapture follow you forever, right? Until you die. And so you have the four D's of real estate. You defer, and then die. You get the step up in basis, and then you get to unwind your portfolio completely. I shouldn't say completely tax-free, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's again, the crown jewel of this transaction is getting that step up in basis upon death. And we just kick the can down the road. For other folks that are out there that might be a little bit younger, that think this is a good idea, but are still in the process of accumulating real estate, you can always use a DST as kind of like a safety net, right? So let's say you're selling a building or a rental property and you have your eye on something in Southwest Florida and a hurricane blows through and for whatever reason that sale just fell through. Well, you can list a DST as kind of a safety net in that 45-day window. So at the very least, you can roll the proceeds into the DST.
Oh, right. So it's kind of like I mentioned that term, the boot, right? That's the extra proceeds from the sale of your business, of your building. But it's good to identify that almost like as an insurance policy in case something catastrophic like that happens.
It is like an insurance policy.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and the other thing too that in terms of diversifying, we talked about going from, you know, potentially office to industrial or multifamily or something like that. Geographic like if you have all your real estate here in Sacramento, you may want to have some of it in South Florida or Texas or somewhere else that you think might be as likely to thrive as, or more likely to thrive than maybe Sacramento. But just to get some of your real estate holdings outside of Sacramento, they're hard to manage when they're out of the territory.
Exactly.
Maybe easier to manage when they're, you know, local.
Exactly. And so all, I shouldn't say all, but most of the multifamily deals that I've done in the DST space have been in Texas, mm-hmm. have been in the Southeast, where you actually are experiencing population growth and companies moving to those areas as well, right? They're experiencing those types of tailwinds. So that's a great point. Not only you get to diversify your real estate portfolio, but you're, you know, getting out of California a little bit too. So that's a good
point. That's huge.
Yeah.
So people, I mean, it seems to me that the big the people that obviously accountants can influence this a lot, but people that are involved in real estate, these are the types of things that they should be well versed in, because typically we're not calling our accountant when we're getting ready to sell a building. We're definitely calling a realtor, right? We're almost always calling the realtor, but the accountant might get called a little later in the game. So I'm thinking about the commercial side. They're more likely, so there's a ton, my daughter's like the president. There's so many residential real estate. Most of them don't have a clue, barely a clue of what we're talking about. I would think that the commercial realtors, they do more likely.
They do not.
Huh.
But I think this is, it's wonderful to at least educate these folks, because at the bare minimum, they'll be able to get over some hurdles and some objections from their clients that are trying to sell whatever it is that they're trying to sell. Because at the end of the day, there's been many cases that I bumped into where the client just says, you know what, I just don't feel like paying the taxes right now, so I'm not going to sell it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they figure, I have two options. Either I have to do a 1031 exchange into another rental property, or I sell it and I have to swallow that jagged little pill of taxes. Right. They don't understand that there is a third option for them, which is the Delaware Statutory Trust.
And I feel like the returns that I'm getting, I might have went into more conservative type investments, but they were like, you get a monthly distribution or quarterly distribution, and it seems like it's about 5%-ish in that realm for these buildings that I invested into. It's not like it's like what I would consider a home run in terms of cash flow, but it's solid, it's respectable, and then, you know, you get your money back at some point.
it's not a home run from a cash flow perspective, especially now that we have a risk-free rate mm-hmm. of 5.455, right?
Right?
You know, that's what money markets and CDs are paying right now. I tell you, 5% cash on cash was pretty sexy 3 years ago, 4 years
right.
ago, but it's not now. You know, so that is certainly a hurdle and an objection that I get from clients.
Are you seeing that change? Are you seeing the let's say I'm just picking up a number. Are you seeing that number that I'm calling a baseline of 5%? Are you seeing the industry find a way to get a better return because they're competing with, you know, your bank account?
No, because cap rates are still,
mm-hmm.
they're still pretty low at the end of the day. In fact, if I do come across a DST offering that is like 7, 8, 9%, I know something is really wrong with that.
Okay, so it's a riskier bet.
It's 100% a riskier bet. I mean, where can you get into something right now that's got 8, 9% cash on cash, right, in real estate? Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's also important where if you do like this concept of the Delaware Statutory Trust, is that you do work with an advisor that can, again, guide you and shepherd you into these bigger sponsors that have been around for 15 or 20 years, managing hundreds of DSTs, and have a great track record of in terms of like not missing coupon payments and having strong exits.
Yeah. Well, so what are the cons in doing something like this? Why would somebody shy away from it, besides maybe the return, right? The 5% versus maybe they can put the money in something more risky, or maybe something more safe that just gets you 5%. Why would somebody shy away from this?
Illiquidity.
Oh yeah.
Is probably the biggest thing. But we're going to know going into a specific deal, again, regardless of what the underlying asset is, we're going to know exactly or estimated how much time it takes for that particular asset to go full cycle, right? So it could be 4 to 6 years, it could be 7 to 9, it could be 10 plus, but we're going to have an idea going into it what that level of illiquidity is. and how we get around that from a solution standpoint is it's not an all or nothing. Right. So if you have $7 million of exchangeable assets, right, those are the net proceeds on your building after you pay debt and all the fees and everything. We don't have to do all $7 million into one DST. We can do two or three DSTs. We can break it up, right? Be diversified. That's number one. And number two, we can take out of that seven, we can take $2 million, take constructive receipt of that, pay your taxes, sail around the world, remodel the kitchen, do what you want with it, and we just exchange $5 million. So it doesn't have to be an all or nothing kind of scenario. And that's kind of how we kind of get around this whole issue of, gosh, I don't want all this money tied up for so long.
So we're talking about what I would characterize as some bigger numbers, $5 million, $10 million. We're in the talking of the millions. What's the minimum? So somebody sells a $500,000 rental property. They have some equity in it. They've got a couple hundred grand in equity. You know, what's the minimum? Can I roll 25 grand into it? Can I roll 100 grand into it?
By the way, thank you for bringing that up, because I do many transactions that are $400,000, $500,000, $700,000. So the minimum typically is about $100,000.
Okay. So you need to have that gain of $100,000 ballpark, and that you're not going to roll into a different 1031 property you're managing, but you want to roll it into something that's kind of more passive, like the DST.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll also say too, that, you know, when these properties go full cycle, or when the trust goes full cycle, whether it be 5, 7, 10 years down the road, you're going to have multiple options there, right? And so the first option is, let's go ahead and do another exchange into another Delaware statutory trust, right? So that's always going to be an option for you. Option number two is going to be like, you know what? My kids need a house, right? So you can actually do an exchange out of the Delaware statutory trust and go back into real estate in some capacity, if that's what you want, right? So there is flexibility.
Go
there.
Roll it into a rental property for your kids.
Go and run. Exactly. It's, you know, so it has a lot of flexibility, and it has options, which I really like. And then, of course, the third option is, you know what, I'm just going to take my money and run. Mm-hmm. But again, if that's the case, you're paying the depreciation, recapture, you're paying all the taxes, that is going to follow you until the day you die.
Yeah, that's that could be a big tax bill.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yep. So we want to avoid that. Okay, so we talked about, I'm going to jump line items here in terms of our tax strategy. Opportunity zones, and those are these areas that have been identified as places that need improvement around the United States, I guess, so that they're like redevelopment type places.
So I believe that this was written in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act specifically. Mm-hmm. And there's about 8,200 zones nationwide that are in some areas that just need some help, right, at the end of the day. And so there's specific incentives that we have as investors, or that the government has put into place as investors to be able to fund these particular areas. And so the biggest advantages of the qualified opportunity zone, and by the way, you alluded to this at the very beginning of the show, most QOZs that I come across are real estate based. They do have some piece of real estate inside of the QOZ wrapper, so to speak, because that's really all it is. It's just a wrapper, and then inside is real estate. So there's a lot of different types of real estate that can come in the QOZs as well, all across the country in these 8,000 plus zones. And what's really nice is, you know, let's say, number one, you can do it after the fact. So let's say, for example, you sell your property, right? You now have $300,000 of cash that's sitting in your bank account that you know inevitably you're going to have to pay taxes on unless you do something. Well, we can stick that $300,000 in a QOZ and defer all the taxes. Okay, so this is the after the fact.
After the fact, so you come see Matt, or you decide you want to put your money into an opportunity zone to defer some taxes, right? Because there's still taxes ultimately that we end up paying, but you can put the money, we take it over to you, and then walk me through that process a little bit, identifying the property, and then when will I actually pay the taxes?
So the transaction has to be done in the tax year that you sold the asset. And I say asset because it does this one doesn't have to be real estate. We're not doing a 1031 exchange. We don't have to involve a qualified intermediary. So that's another advantage as well. It's a little bit more simplistic of a mechanism or
but most
solution.
Of the properties or the properties inside that you're investing into opportunity zones, they are real estate based.
Most of them.
Yeah.
There's some oil and gas QOZs as well, which are a little bit nuanced and certainly more, they're riskier for sure. But we would then identify, and again, you could sell, it could be a piece of real estate that you sell. It could be Bitcoin that you sell. It could be concentrated stock that you sell. It could be part of a business that you sell, right? All after the fact, we can then utilize the QOZ to actually defer those taxes. Those taxes are deferred into the year 2025.
Yeah. So now it's not that far away. It's a couple years away.
Yeah.
So that's, soon. Yeah. So is that diminished now? I mean, because you mentioned 2017, some legislation was written.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine that 2025 looked good, 10 years earlier or whatever, 8 years earlier, yeah. But it doesn't look as good. It's only a couple years away.
That's exactly right. And so that's the biggest challenge, I think, for an investor of the QOZ is that it's fun that we get to defer our taxes this year, but I'm eventually going to have to pay it in the next, 18 to 24 months, which is kind of a bummer. But a silver lining to that, I guess, is that the money that you put inside of the QOZ, that if you keep it there for the full 10 years, any gain that is associated with that investment is completely tax-free.
Yeah.
And so that's another incentive that we have in terms of moving money or investing into the QOZ, is that all of the gains are tax-free after 10 years.
All the gains after you buy the property are tax-free.
Correct.
You still got the gain, the original gain that you pay in 2025. And then at the end of the 10 years, if you still got the property and you sell it, then whatever appreciation you got during that period, you're going to pay tax on. But I have to imagine, and even in that scenario, it's attractive at some level, but you could, if you didn't do the opportunity zone, you could 1031 it again or go into a DST.
No. Remember, this is after the fact. 1031 is not an option because the transaction has already been conducted.
Right.
Okay, so you've already taken
that part is handled. Yeah.
So you've already taken constructive receipt. And so that's the biggest difference with the QOZ versus say the Delaware Statutory Trust or the Deferred Sales Trust, which we're going to get into in a minute, is that this is kind of after the fact, like, oops, I didn't know about these solutions. I need to defer taxes at least this year because I have a massive tax bill. It'd be less painful if I did it and pay the taxes in 2025, right? And then again, if we keep that, let's say you invest $300,000, that $300,000 grows to $600,000 in 10 years, you get that $600,000 all tax-free, right? All that entire growth or gain is tax-free, which is nice.
And in terms of identifying those properties, is it similar to the Delaware Statutory Trust?
Yes.
Where you kind of have the sponsor out there and this person sort of oversees the portfolio and you pick and choose from that menu?
Exactly. And that's why sponsor selection and sponsor track record is so important and paramount.
And I would think that it's important to point out that you're buying in what some people have deemed depressed areas. Mm-hmm. So that's got to add some amount of risk. Typically, there's, you don't know when the revitalization effort is going to get traction. And sometimes it takes a while.
These are challenged areas in our country for sure. But there's some outliers there, and I'll give you an example. I did a deal with a client. We put some money in a QOZ that was actually focusing on student housing for University of Southern California. Right. So it was USC. It was on a USC just outside of the USC campus. Right. So there's some areas that surprisingly you're like, wow, that's really a QOZ or qualified. Are you sure? Yeah, that's
too nice.
So there are pockets like that, right, where it's not necessarily that economically depressed that we can kind of take advantage of because of the tax code.
Interesting. Okay, so let's move on, because that one's going to be a little bit less popular at the moment, unless they rewrite some of these, some of these dates to get updated. Because I think, stepping back too, you think about what the government was trying to do. They're trying to help some of these areas that need some investment.
Yeah.
So it makes communities stronger, safer, and so on. And so there's a lot of anything we can do to reduce taxes is good, but also incentivize, how we go about reducing our taxes. So it's good for, it's good for society.
It's good for society. And that's a great point, is that the clients that I've introduced a solution to and have taken advantage of it, they feel really good. It's one of those things where not only do I get to defer some taxes for a couple of years, but you know what? It's kind of like ESG, right? It's it's my way of investing and also giving back simultaneously. So it makes them feel good at the end of the day. So that's a really good point.
Makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So the final one, the deferred sales trust.
The deferred sales trust.
I have had people come and talk to me about this over the years. Yeah. I've never taken advantage of this one, but is this one... why don't we go into it, and then I'll start asking some questions. Maybe give us an overview of what that is, and then we can maybe I'll try to ask questions that help us decide whether it's right for us.
We can peel back the onion for sure, but I will say, as somewhat of a disclosure, I work with a team that has estate planning attorneys, tax attorneys. They're called the estate planning team, as a matter of fact, EPT. I am associated with that team. They are the ones that set up the contract. They are the ones that work directly with my client and or prospect to set up the contract directly, right? So I do have enough knowledge on the deferred sales trust to be dangerous, but at the end of the day, I can get at my river's edge, so to speak, as it relates to some of the nuances. And I always bring in these tax experts.
That's interesting, because that's what other people have told me about this, and I had to question in my own mind. I thought I was going to have an opportunity to use one at one point, and so I was thinking seriously about it, but all the special disclaimers had me going, what's the IRS going to think about this? If it's this many specialists involved, is the IRS good?
No, it's true. I mean, because it's a more complicated solution. There's no doubt about it. And its complexities have scared some of my clients away, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Matt, this seems like a great idea, but gosh, there's a lot of moving parts and I don't think it's necessarily for me. And that's fine. That's okay. But at the end of the day, this is just a Section 453 in the IRS tax code installment sale, which has been around for 100 years. It's been around since the 1920s.
Yeah, and so an installment sale for our listeners is they pay us over time, right? We're gonna sell something and they pay through installments.
They pay through installments, but the mechanism exactly is if you're selling a bit, it could be really any asset. There are some limits in terms of what assets we can throw in here, but generally speaking, we can do quite a few. It just doesn't have to be real estate. It can be a business, et cetera. So we lend the business or the asset to the trust. The trust issues a promissory note. That promissory note has very specific terms. Might be 7 years, might be 10 years, and it's got an interest rate associated with it as well. We come up with those terms as the wealth advisor to the client, and also bringing in the estate planning team as well.
So if you don't need cash flow off of that, could you set it at like 1% terms? So,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a client right now that's not... We sold the business. We put all proceeds in the deferred sales trust, and it's just sitting there growing for him.
So it's growing in this trust because you're investing that money in other stuff.
In other stuff, and he doesn't exactly. And that's we'll talk about in a second in terms of what we can put in it and what we can invest in the deferred sales trust. But yes.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to walk myself through. Let's say I sold my company. Had no basis, and I sold for $50 million. Hit it out of the park, really good exit. Now I've got this $50 million, and like, oh man, I can't 1031 exchange on a sale of a company. So I'm going to take a little. Let's say $50 million is how much I have to pay taxes on. I put it into this, I lend the asset. When so do I
you gotta do
that?
You got to do it before.
Before the LOI? Or before the, like before your, so people listening, so if you sell your company, a lot of times there's a letter of intent, kind of like an offer, and then you agree upon that, and then it's almost like you're in that escrow period, if you will, where they do their due diligence and they look under the hood to make sure they really want to buy it, and then you finally close after 90 days or 180 days or whatever it takes. So there's that window. Do you have to do it, where in that, is it before that window starts or during
ideally,
the window?
Ideally before that window starts.
Okay.
We have done it during that window and okay. it was a tester.
Okay. In what ways is it a tester? Is it a tester in terms of the IRS or is it a tester in terms of timing and get all the crap
timing,
done?
Timing and getting everything done at the end of the day, you know, and by the way, going back to the IRS, right? Again, this is an installment sale and, again, to just reiterate on how this mechanism works, you lend the asset to the trust. The trust gives you a promissory note. The trust then sells the asset to the third party buyer.
Okay.
Right. And then so the trust receives the proceeds.
So you basically change ownership of your company while you're in escrow, you know, to use my layman terms. So yeah, or you could do it before. It's better to do it before.
It's better to do it before.
Right.
For sure. So we're not running around.
Would you say that maybe, well, so when's the right time to do it? Because let's say you're beginning to contemplate some of these things. Hey, my company's gone up in value. I'm working more on my business than in my business. There's a management team in place. It's kind of running itself at some level. It's got a lot of value. You never know. I might start thinking about, you know, I've got a lot of my net worth tied up in my business. Most of us do.
It's never
too early. 2 years out?
It's never too early.
Okay.
It's never too early. At the end of the day, right? Like, it's never too early to figure out what your options are and what solutions.
But there's a cost associated with doing all of this. So you want to make sure you have enough net worth to pay people pay your attorneys to get it all done.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be no cost unless the transaction's actually completed, right?
Okay.
And so I think that's the beauty of it as well, is that if we do start early, we can start our conversations, we can figure out whether or not it's the right solution for you. And at the end of the day, right, if you come up to an exit in the next 6 to 12 months, you decide not to do it, but there's no hard feelings. There's a lot of time that we spent on that, but that's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
That's a part of the deal.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what are the, there's pros and cons. So we all, salivate over the idea of not paying taxes or, you know, deferring them. Maybe walk us through almost like the pros and cons, if you don't mind.
Well, I mean, the biggest advantage or the biggest pro is certainly tax deferral.
Yeah.
Right. That is absolutely enormous. And, you know, think about the power of compound interest, right? If we're not paying taxes and, you know, to your point, as it relates to selling your business and having a zero basis, that's not uncommon, right? Most business owners have a zero basis. Also, I would argue too, that most real estate folks that have been in their realm for 35, 40, 45 years, they've depreciated. They're building significantly and their basis is pretty low as well. So this is a wonderful tool for people, whether it be real estate. We don't have to do a 1031. We don't have to do a 1031 exchange. We can sell highly concentrated stock and put the proceeds in this. So again, it's open to most assets. That's the biggest advantage. And also in addition to that, we can extend the terms of the note. So there's not necessarily a deadline, right? Just because the note is in place for 7 years or 10 years doesn't necessarily mean at the end of the term that you're going to have to face that hefty tax bill, so to speak, right? So that's advantage number two, because we can restructure the note at the end of the 10 years.
Okay.
All right. Which is extremely helpful. And in the event of your death, well, guess what? Then your heirs just take over the note. No big deal.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can basically just continue to keep deferring.
You can continue to defer, correct?
Yeah.
Or again, if you're having a massive liquidity event and you're facing an enormous tax bill, maybe you spread it out over the next 10 years, right? Because maybe you're not liquid and maybe you do need part of that asset or part of that sale every single year. So instead of paying a massive tax bill in the year that you sell this business or you sell this commercial property, maybe we structure a 10-year note and we go ahead and dwindle it and take bite-sized pieces of the taxes versus a big bite that's very hard to digest in year number one. So we can structure this thing 10 different ways from Sunday, which is really nice.
And like how often, I rarely hear people use this. I've heard people use it. Of course, people that have this all this success, a lot of times they're not going around talking about this kind of stuff, which is why this is kind of a unique opportunity. It's like, right. Where else would you hear this if you're not running in some of those circles, like the Entrepreneurs Organization and other organizations where you have these people that are building companies that have real value, and then they're hoping for a liquidity event at some point. So this is really kind of a unique opportunity to kind of go deeper on this stuff. But what's too small to even, like, it's not worth it. It's like, is a $5 million gain? Like, if you sell your company for $5 million, that's a good number, but
it's a great number.
Okay.
It's a great number.
What's the minimum that you would, because, you know, these sales of companies, they're all small business, you might get $500,000, $1 million.
There is no minimum.
Okay.
I mean, I just did one a couple months ago for $900,000.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, so we're talking about the advantages and we're going to go into the disadvantages in a second, right? So I already talked about two or three advantages. Another advantage is that within the trust, and this is where I come in, right? I leverage that estate planning team, you know, to walk my clients through all of the nuances, the bells and whistles, the risks associated with it, et cetera, where I come into play, where the value that I add as it relates to this transaction is not only introducing you to the solution, but also managing the assets inside of the trust. That's my job. So once you experience that liquidity event, the trust is already set up, proceeds go into the trust, then we have a conversation based on your risk tolerance, your time horizon, your liquidity needs, how we're going to set up this note and how we're going to manage it inside of it. And I can buy anything inside of it. We can even buy real estate inside of the trust, which is wonderful, right? And so there are no restrictions. There's always some sort of restriction, but there's a lot of flexibility in terms of the investments that we can make once the proceeds are inside the trust. So that's another big advantage.
And does the person that has sold the company, the business owner, is he or she limited in what handcuffs are on that person in terms of being able to make decisions on that stuff after you do the original deal?
We come up with an IPS or an investment policy statement, which basically is a guideline in terms of how we're going to be investing the money, again, based on risk tolerance, time horizon, liquidity needs.
And then somebody else manages that. No, it's like a third party.
No, I manage. I manage all of that, right? But it's in conjunction with the trustee.
Right. So you guys are that third party. And is that part of how the law or the regulations work in terms of like, it's not mine anymore because it's yes. in this trust.
Gotta
it's
have
not
that.
Me.
Yep. Yeah. That's true. And you got to have that impartial third party trustee, which you can't decide, by the way. There's about six trustees that are part of this team nationwide. So I exclusively use one trustee that's down in Southern California to be my trustee on all of these cases.
Okay. Yeah. And you follow whatever the initial guidelines are for, you know, investing and the terms and all that stuff.
I create it with the client.
Oh,
yeah. The trustee is just there to kind of sign off on it just to make sure that it's viable.
And once it's signed off on, he or she is no longer integrated into that unless it's part of the, you can have a discussion, I suppose, about what the general area that you want to go, but it actually is a third arm's length sort of scenario.
Arm's length sort of scenario, but that trustee actually has to sign off on any moves that we make with inside of the trust, right? And so it's not just
to say that it ties to the original guidelines of the trust.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. So it's not like it's just like, oh, it's set up. We got it on autopilot, Mark. It's just going to be the two of us managing this thing. The trustee is still going to be involved in some capacity, but it is an arm's length kind of relationship.
Okay, cool. What else did I not ask? Okay, we didn't get in the cons, did we?
We didn't, and
okay.
We need to.
Okay, tell me about that.
No, I think the biggest one, especially for somebody that is considering a deferred sales trust coming out of real estate, okay? Low basis, high gain situation, coming out of real estate, you go into this trust, you are going to lose that step up in basis. There is no step up in basis in the deferred sales trust. So remember the advantage that we talked about before with the Delaware statutory trust. You defer, mm-hmm. and then you die. You get the step up in basis. Kids get to liquidate, right? Yeah. Tax-free. Not in this situation. So we're going to lose that ability in the event that we put the proceeds into the deferred sales trust.
Does that mean typically it just sort of stays in, it just stays in that, and the kids are more likely than not are just going to, unless they really need the money, are going to just sort of leave it there?
Yeah. Or I mean, the kids can leave it there and they can collect an income off of whatever mm-hmm. we're generating off of it. Right. But that is a big disadvantage, in my opinion, and something that I need to highlight with real estate investors on the very front end of this thing, is that we're going to lose that, which some people are undeterred by, and then there's others that, that's a pretty big deal, and rightfully so. So I would say that's the biggest risk. The second thing, is it's a more complex deal on the front end, and there are fees, right? Everyone's got to get paid. And
that's kind of where I was going with the size of the transaction. If there's a size of the transaction is not big enough to warrant the fees.
Yeah, the smaller the it's scaled. The transaction, lower the fees.
Okay. So it's like a percentage.
It's like a percentage. Yeah. I can't talk specifics as it relates to the fees today, but, it's the cost of doing business, right? But at the end of the day, would you rather pay somebody fees, or would you rather pay?
You threw out some possible numbers that are, the audience won't hold us to, but you could pay 30, 40, maybe more. Even some cases, there's ordinary income associated with these things.
It's insane.
Yeah, it can get expensive in taxes. What about state taxes? How does all this work with state taxes versus, I keep bringing up the IRS, but we've got state taxes that could be considered too. Is this all for a state too?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, with a capital gains tax, there's federal, there's state, which is a progressive state tax, mm-hmm. right? The bigger the gain, the more, the higher the percentage that you're going to pay. There's Medicare tax associated with that, right? If it's real estate, you're going to have depreciation recapture. That could be massive as well. It's expensive to not at least consider these particular options, whether it's the Delaware Statutory Trust, the QOZ, which again is less attractive in today's environment, but also the Deferred Sales Trust.
So what did I not ask you about these three programs that, I was sort of directing the flow of the conversation. Sometimes that prohibits you from maybe getting the word in that you needed to get in. What did I not ask that's kind of like kind of basic, or maybe it's a nuanced thing that is helpful to know?
I think we've covered a lot in a short amount of time, quite frankly.
It's pretty technical, so if you're watching this, you might have to watch it twice or listen to it twice just to kind of go like, okay, or call you or, talk to a professional that gets this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and it's, there's the reason why I've experienced a fair amount of success over the years is we talked about specialization, right? Having a focus, right? This has been my specialization. There's other there's a million guys that do what I do, right? There's a million wealth advisors, but there's very few that do this. And there's even less that know about it, right? And so I think that's important for the audience to know, is even if you do have a very trusted advisor that's been your person for 20, 25, 30 years, just because they haven't heard about these concepts doesn't necessarily mean they may not be right for you. Or they may not. Yeah.
Is it worth considering? I would assume you probably get some of your deal flow from other financial advisors and wealth managers.
I do get some of my deal flow from other advisors. Yeah. How ironic is that?
Right. So they're in some ways co-opetition. It might view you as competition, but I'm sure there's some sort of working relationship where, like, look, I'm not going to, I'll help with the transaction without trying to steer your client away from, all your other investments.
No, of course not.
That.
No.
It's cooperative.
No. It's cooperative. Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, that other advisor just wants to make sure that his client is taken care of.
Yeah. So if you are listening and you're like, oh, I'm one of those guys, but I really like my stockbroker, if you will, and, you feel bad about leaving him or her, there's a cooperation approach.
100%. Yeah. We all will play together really well in the sandbox. There's that's for sure.
That's cool to hear.
And again, you know, like you had mentioned in that very onset of this podcast, these are pretty complicated solutions that not everyone has access to, number one. And number two, I'm pretty limited in terms of what I can really talk about today. So if anyone is interested in discussing these solutions, I encourage you to give me a call or look me up on my website for sure.
Okay, so lightning round, if you don't mind here.
Do it. Let's do it.
About the economy.
Yes.
So again, you're not an economist, right? But are you technically an economist? I didn't know.
No, I know a fair amount about the global macroeconomic environment. So yeah. That's part of my job and my role.
Okay,
yeah.
So give me a lightning answer. What's the state of the macro global environment?
That's a very, very... Okay.
I stumped him. Geez.
No,
okay.
No, it's just, where do I begin?
Yeah.
So I guess I'll say everyone right now is really thinking about interest rates, right? Especially people that are watching this show. You're probably thinking about, oh my gosh, are interest rates going to continue to rise? When are they going to go down? How's this going to affect my portfolio and things of that nature? So let's just start there. Keep in mind that the Federal Reserve really has two goals at the end of the day, right? The Federal Reserve wants to make sure that, number one, Americans are gainfully employed. Mm-hmm. So they pay very close attention to the unemployment rate, and they want to make sure that there's a lot of people that are gainfully employed. Number two, and more importantly, they have monetary policy, right? And so they closely monitor inflation. So inflation is their enemy. And whenever inflation creeps up in some capacity, it is their job to snuff it out in any way possible. What we've had since 2020, 2021 is unprecedented monetary stimulus over the past 3 or 4 years. Helicopter money, right? And as a result of that, and there's some other nuances here too, but as a result of that, we now have unprecedented inflationary pressures. We went from an inflation rate of 1.5 to 2 to pretty close to 10 overnight. We've never seen anything like that before. And so what the Fed has to do in order to combat that is they have to suck liquidity back out of the system, right? That's their sole goal, is how do we have all this liquidity out in the system now. We grew the monetary base. How do we start to shrink it? Right. And one of the areas that they do that in is, of course, trying to slow demand. They are trying, and this is almost counterintuitive, and I talk to my clients about this all the time. The Fed is raising rates because they want to slow the economy. Isn't that wild?
Okay. So,
you know what?
Yes, 100%. It's okay. So, yes or no on this? Are we approaching stagflation? I predict that we are approaching this. We're going to approach, we're going to stay with higher than the desired inflation, and the economy is going to slow. And so that's my prediction, is something that feels like stagflation, which a lot of people think is negative.
I think the Fed has done a wonderful job. Everyone wants to armchair quarterback Jay Powell for what he's done over the years. I think he's done a wonderful job. M2, or the supply of money, has contracted pretty significantly over the past 12 to 18 months. Inflationary pressures are starting to abate, specifically in some areas, not necessarily in others. And so I hope you're wrong, Mark. Uh-huh. No disrespect.
Yeah, and I don't have all. Obviously, there's so many unknowns.
There's so many unknowns.
You see the decoupling with China, yep. And you see the onshoring, and you see this big stimulus that we've got to try to drive the CHIPS Act and all these other different things that we're doing to sort of force spending in a way from the government, and so there are some inflationary pressures yet. We're raising rates so that they're trying to curb employment.
They're trying to curb employment. They're trying to curb employment. Well, they're trying to curb
inflation growth within the employee sector.
Slow demand, and they won't say this out loud, but they want the unemployment rate to tick up a little bit, right?
But then you have these unions, right? I don't know how many strikes we got going on right now. I'm like waiting for the NFL to go on strike. It's all these kind of labor disputes going. It's like, I don't feel like, even though, you know, you feel like there's maybe some lessening effects of it or lessening inflation, it's like, gosh, you're not building as many houses as we need. There's, I mean, I feel like we may go through a time of continued inflation and
with lower growth.
Yeah, with lower growth, yeah. Or maybe even no growth at some point. Okay, lightning. This is lightning round. I forgot. Okay, Sacramento economy. What do you think about Sacramento's economy at the moment? Because you are an investor into the growth factory. Obviously, you've got some piece of your net worth into high growth startups and really giving back to the community, which is part of like what we do. And this is not. Our fund is full. This is not seeking money. This is more like, look, we are a piece of the entrepreneurial ecosystem, which is a part of the Sacramento economy. But you must believe in it a little bit. You live here. You're raising a family here. You invested in the growth factory. You know, hopes for Sacramento or belief in Sacramento?
I have a tremendous belief in Sacramento. I mean, I've only been out here for 13 years, but just in the 13 years that I've been here, I've seen tremendous growth. Tremendous growth. Think about all areas around us, both Sacramento proper and also the suburbs. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. So I have certainly faith in our community. I have faith in our leaders in our community to some extent. But I think this is a fantastic place to live. We have deep roots now, even after 13 years. And I, you know, to answer your question a little bit more intimately, I guess. You know, we have tremendous tailwinds from the Bay Area as it relates to, you know, money coming into the, you know, from a housing standpoint. And you know, the housing, I don't think there's going to be a housing crisis. I think there's more pain to come in the real estate sector for sure. And I'm not suggesting that our communities are going to be insulated from this pain, but I think there's going to be less pain in our community simply because of all the tailwinds that are associated from the Bay Area. Most of my new friends now, most of the people that I meet, they're from San Jose, they're from Walnut Creek, they're from San Ramon, right? Mm-hmm. All those areas.
Yeah, they've came here. And yeah. I think the other thing that within Sacramento is there's a movement coming, and part of it is this backyard advantage that we are building. But one of the things that's different about a family or a business or a community, if you are scrappy enough, right, if you bring enough imagination, enough courage, enough love to your family, to your business, to your community, it doesn't matter what the macro economy is doing in some cases. You can still win even in a stagflationary environment or whatever else, you know, the world throws at us.
That's very well said, Mark.
Yeah.
That's what makes you right there.
I'm just a hometown guy, simple guy, but very open-minded and wanting to learn. I think that's part of why I love this show, is because I'm learning perspectives, because nobody knows it all. So there's perspectives, and really we need to bring in people on our show that really get it and see things in ways that we don't. So I really appreciate what you see that our audience and I don't necessarily see, and so that we can sort of weigh out how we want to live our life and how we might want to make sure that our future is as strong as possible. So thank you. And
thanks
appreciate
so much
you
for
coming
having
on the
me.
Show.
I appreciate it, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.